Well, hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Diana Wiley. And I am so pleased because Dr. Linda DeVillers, who is the author of Love Skills, A Fun, Upbeat Guide to Successful Relationships, is with us again. This is a wonderful book. It provides a step-by-step program for sexual fun, adventure, and growth. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Linda.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
And we talked off the air, and we're going to start the program with something a little more personal because, well, we have a number of things in common, and of course, we've known each other way back to 1991, maybe even before that. But in both of our New Year's letters, 2018, we announced the death of our mothers. And so we're going to spend a few minutes talking about mother-daughter relationships. And then we're going to go on to, because of our particular mother-daughter relationship, we both have, as far as we can determine, secure attachment. And then we're going to talk about touch, the importance of touch, which is a big part of Dr. Linda's book, Love Skills. And then we're going to go on to body image. So that's our intention. And Dr. Linda DeVillers will be with us again, part two to be determined. So your mother lived a long time. There are not that many people that live 100 plus years. Can you talk about that a little more and how she influenced your life and I'll do the same. We'll make this a tribute to our respective mothers.
Well, for starters, I'm pleased to announce my mother was never hospitalized for any major emergency, except twice in the last maybe 7 years, and both times it was for dehydration. In other words, it was not emergency surgery. It was not a stroke. It was not, you know, cardiac arrest or whatever. And she was known throughout her life for being very committed to exercise and good eating. And in other words, she took care of herself. She was very active. She had a rich social life, and she was literally loved by everyone. She was called a monarch, the queen monarch of the yoga class that she took at Santa Monica College Emeritus up to her 99th year.
Oh, that's great. And, no wonder she was so healthy.
Somebody we both know named Maria Flaherty, who was also a wonderful sex therapist person, retired now. But my mother
just to interrupt, she was my supervisor when I was earning my 3,000 hours. She was one of my supervisors. And we co-led two women's groups together for 11 years. So I'm sorry I missed Maria Flaherty's 80th. I know you and your partner, DJ, went to her birthday.
Yes, we did. Yes,
sorry I missed it because she is a wonderful woman.
But what I was about to say is, so her son owned a condo in the Tahoe area, and, you know, can't explain the details, but my mother and I went skiing with Maria and Jim on two separate occasions, and my mother and she were in the same ski class, and, she, you know, this is my mother in her mid-80s skiing. My mother only stopped skiing because she developed macular degeneration at 87 and had to stop, but Maria was inspired by my mother to go scuba diving in Australia when the WASP was in Australia. Oh, no, when the Olympics were in that neck of the woods.
Yeah.
So she was very active, everybody loved her. And that's just the way it was. And so as I was telling you earlier today, you know, I dared to make the un-PC statement in my Christmas letter.
Yes, you did.
I was a little miffed at, now I'm going to even lose her name, Greta, what's her last name? Greta
Gerwig. G-E-R-W-I-G. Gerwig, I guess it is.
I heard her on NPR, and she said, well, we all know that all mothers have complicated, conflictful relationships. And I thought, excuse me? I didn't. And my mother was instead, she was my confidant. She was my cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
When people, I did not mention this to you earlier, but when people, I don't know if the word would be challenged, but when people said to her, your daughter is specializing in sexuality,
mm-hmm.
isn't that a little frivolous for somebody like her? My mother stood up 100% for the fact that this was a very needed field and that it was very legitimate and that she was proud of me. So,
you know, I had a very similar reaction from my mother, and my mother lived. Your mother died in early April, and my mother died mm-hmm. in August at 95, so mm-hmm. she didn't quite reach 100. She wanted to, but I sent her part of what I received from after her death were some of her books mm-hmm. and many other things, but. So this book that I gave her on Mother's Day, 1997, so more than 20 years ago, mm-hmm. Mothers and Daughters, a celebration from the authors of the best-selling Sisters. And I wrote in the book, I inscribed, Dearest Mom, you are the best. Everything you have done as a mother is from love, unconditional love. In your love, you have allowed me to be my, have allowed me my own journey, which has led me, in parentheses, peripatetic detours and all, in parentheses, to this life, and this is with my late husband, Charlie, in paradise. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
In your love, by your shining example, I have been a good mother to my own children. Thank you. I love you,
that's
mother.
Amazing.
And that's the thing about secure attachment. It is generated, and I know that I was a better mother because of her role modeling. Now, my relationship with my daughter is much better now that she, years ago, left being a teenager. But
I remember meeting her. I thought she was great.
Yeah, she's lovely, and she's bright, and she has two little boys that are my adorable grandsons that I'm very proud of. The secure attachment is really important. But before we go on to that, did you want to say anything else about your mother? Because she was a pretty special lady.
Yeah, she was. Gosh. Well, it's like, and we're sort of both bragging about our mothers. But
yeah.
One of my friends, as an adult, only about 8 or 10 years ago, she just quipped, well, you know, you had the model mom.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't mean that I didn't, you know, did I fail to appreciate my mother? But it really hit me when
mm-hmm.
she said that. I thought, you know, you are so right.
Mm-hmm.
I really did. And some of the other words, it wasn't just that she was a nice person. We didn't yell and scream at each other. And my father, by the way, was equally wonderful, much more quiet. But I didn't grow up in a yelly, screaming, let's put each other down kind of environment. But she was so reliable. You know, if my mother said she was going to do something, she did it.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And I think that relates a lot to this concept of security.
Absolutely, it does, because our attachment experience influences whether we see ourselves as lovable. And if you've got if you have a partner who does what he or she says she's going to do, then that usually comes from having secure attachment. And I had that too. I mean, I got to see, in fact, in your book, Love Skills, you have a 32-year-old woman named Diane, and I just want to read this quote from her because it really resonated for me. I mean, I could really say the same thing. I was raised in a family that was pretty positive about sex and physical displays of affection. My parents hugged and kissed and touched a lot. I've never felt the kind of shame and guilt over enjoying my body during sex that some of my other friends have described. And this was one of your clients or maybe one of your students,
right.
Age 32. And I've often thought back to how fortunate I was to have parents who were affectionate with each other, and with each other and with us. And, you know, I got the facts of life talk from both of them when my sister and I were driving. We were driving from San Francisco down to L.A. Well, the sex talk started about Santa Barbara, but we were captive audience.
I was going to say, you were caged in the car. That wasn't an accident, huh?
Right, right. As soon as I heard my father say yes, to conceive a child, the penis must go into the vagina. And I just was shocked. Who would know that one day, I was like 10 or 11, that I'd be a sex therapist? I just was shocked. And I remember my mother saying, oh, Diana, don't, you don't have to look out the window. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. And you had similar experiences. Aren't we fortunate? And it's probably not any great surprise that we went into the field of sexuality.
Right. And, you know, I think we probably both are. I'm aware that many people pick specialties because it's their deficit or they need to work on it, work through it, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why I got into sexuality.
Me neither. Say more about that,
yeah.
Because I was shocked when I first went into the field that there were a lot of, it seemed like, well, I mean, this is the same as for you, maybe 35 years ago. There were a lot of people at the conferences that I thought seemed a little insecure about their sexuality. That was my take on it anyway. And it's like, you know, you take in college, you might take abnormal psych 101 to find out, well, how come I'm so screwed up? Well, I better find out. And you and I had an advantage because we came out of these good families that were open about sexuality.
Right. And I think along with that, and there's a video I show right now that in my classes that's very contemporary. You probably saw it, Orgasm Inc. You know, it's the one that makes quite a case about the medicalization of female disorders, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But there's in that film, there's a little segment about, so how did you first learn about sex? And the bottom line that comes out from most of those participants that were college undergrads was from peers.
Mm-hmm.
I did not learn about sex from peers. I did not have my period and then go, oh, what happened?
Right.
That's not what my experience was. I confess, I don't think my mother told me about orgasm, but I think what happened is once I was in college and there were some books on the shelf in a bookstore, I remember this, I just stood there in the stack, as it were, and started reading, and I learned everything that I had been left out in terms of details in that way. But I was not learning, you know, street stuff.
You know, I remember being in my early 20s and searching around for more information about sexuality, and it was not as available as it is today. I mean, you really had to get it to search for it. And my father and mother married, it's World War II time. They were both young. They were both virgins. And my father, my mother told me that my father wanted to be the best lover he could be. So the way he learned about sexuality was to get medical books. And that was all that was available in the late 30s, early 40s. there just wasn't that much sex education. And,
well,
yeah.
Let me do a variation of that. My father was a physician, and he was a divorced man, though. He was an older man. My mother married also at 20. My dad was 31. And, however, I think he knew what a clitoris was. I'm quite convinced he knew from the get-go what a clitoris was. And I recall, as a mid-teen, I know how I learned all the details. My father, they owned the sexual response of the human female, and which was written in, I think, 53, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, 53. So I think I'm talking about long about mid-50s. I'm up there using a sun lamp, and I discover this book. And I will be brazenly TMI. I learned how to masturbate by reading Kinsey.
Kinsey, that would have been Kinsey, and then Masters and Johnson followed up.
Yeah, right. But this was just the data on who did what, you know.
Well, yeah, that's great.
Machine. And
you were very precocious, you know, Linda.
But do remember, this was on the bedroom stand of my parents, so I imagine they were doing a little reading as well.
Yeah. Again, we're very fortunate, and I think we want to talk.
Right.
Because a lot of people in the listening audience were not as fortunate to come out of secure attachment. And I think it'd be good for us to talk a little bit about, like, for instance, if a securely attached person is with an anxiously attached person, I think it's important to be receptive to his or her desire for security and allay fears when second-guessing or smothering seems to be going on. And if you're with an avoidantly attached person who is clamming up, talk about how much you can give him or her the space that the person might need to realize what they want, and get him to talk more openly. And, you know, we both know and love, well, I presume you love Stella Resnick and her book, The Pleasure Zone. It talks about her, she had apparently a anxious and avoidant attachment. Her stepfather beat her, and her mother just wasn't available to her. So then she marries Alan, and she's been with him for 30 plus years. And and then she said that she got earned secure attachment by being with Alan, because he was securely attached, came out of a really different background than hers. She grew up kind of poor in Brooklyn, and he grew up upper middle class in Pasadena. But he had secure attachment, so she always says that she had earned secure attachment just by being with him, and I think that does happen.
Yes, that's fascinating. I didn't know that. Somehow I thought I knew her mother was very problematic. I was thinking that she was positively attached to her dad, but I guess I missed.
Oh no, she was. But this was a stepfather that she was growing up with her mother. Her father lived to be quite. And yes, and she had that. So that also helped her.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, back to the concept that you were talking about. As you know, I'm a big fan of something I call baby steps.
Yes.
So, you know, if the more secure person is going to introduce the less secure person, I think it means you can't be overbearing and you can't say, "What's the matter with you? I mean, this is just
right."
Nothing. You know, instead you have to do the little things. And it's why, I mean, I know that you're very aware of it, but one of the first exercises in my book, and it's one that originally came from a surrogate partner, by the way, who had written a book about this in the late 80s, but it's called Hands, Feet, or Face.
Yeah.
And it has to, it makes multiple points that you're going to begin at the beginning. And even when you do hands, feet, face, let's suppose it is the less secure person, you've given them a choice. You haven't just said, we're going to do a hand caress now. You've mm-hmm. said, here are three different body parts, rather differently located, by the way. Which one appeals to you the most? And you let that person pick that venue. You mm-hmm. make it very, very clear that this is not something that's supposed to segue into sexual activity. And if mm-hmm. what do you want me to do this for? Well, because it's ironic you were talking about this so much, you're going to build trust and connection with this exercise, ideally. There's a chance you won't like it, and we'll explore that if that happens. But I don't think I've ever had somebody ever have a negative experience. But I think I'm trying to make the point, you don't want to say, you will experience. You know, you'll experience whatever it is you experience. And then you'll come back into the session, and we will talk more about it and what you did like and what you noticed, because it's so much about awakening awareness
yes.
of things.
And that's why you suggest that with the caressing exercises that the couple, and I do the same, I tend to call it more sensate focus, and you have good reasons for calling it caressing, and we'll get into mm-hmm. that in a minute. But so between, you take turns, giver, receiver, but in between mm-hmm. trading, that's when you have the discussion about what it was like.
Exactly. Don't do it during. I've sometimes said to people, you may want to do the exercise more than once, definitely on separate occasions. But the first time you do this, I don't want verbal interaction at all, unless you're being injured. You know, that's how I sort of put it.
Yeah, or uncomfortable, really uncomfortable. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And do the feedback afterwards. And that if you did repeat that, you know, you would give intermittent feedback. Wow, that feels really good. Or could you go over here? I like it here, or a little firmer. Whatever the specific feedback would be.
I know that it makes such a difference for so many couples to take intercourse off the table, so to speak, and to get them to slow down and to appreciate hands, feet, and face in the beginning. And because a lot of people are so, well, this is what Masters and Johnson said, that so many people are so genitally focused and need to get beyond the genitals, and because there are all these other possibilities from the top of our head to the bottom of our feet. There are so many erotic zones, pleasure zones, and some people simply get stuck between the legs. So let's expand our erotic potential.
Exactly. And I call them hot spots.
Hot spots, right. Hot spots.
You know, give up the G spot, please, you know. I just have some pretty strong feelings about that, especially when it's the quest for, you know, an obsession with trying to find one specific spot. It's just so.
Oh, and people really saying, oh, my goodness, I need a directional GPS to find it. They get all caught up in
Right, exactly. That's funny. Yeah.
But, of course, finding the G-spot can be an add-on, but I agree with you that
I'm going to be a devil's advocate there because, you know, they're no longer around to interview, but Hartman and Fithian were trained by Masters and Johnson, and they were at Cal State Long Beach. I am told, and I knew them at the time they were actually there, that the equipment that they had was actually a little upgraded from Masters and Johnson's machines. It should have been. But one of the things I'll never forget Hartman saying was that, you know, we did ask women about erotic sensitivity inside the vagina and where it was. And according, I think it's in their book even, that they found a certain number of women reported if you were to view the vagina as a clock and think about the hands of a clock, They often reported sensations at the 4 and 8 o'clock time slot, which is not where a G-spot would be. And so I still think it's much more meaningful to say, if you're interested in exploring internal, you know, sensitivities, just explore, find it. Mm-hmm. It does not have to be in exactly where some book told you it was supposed to be. Because it might be in a slightly, it might be in an adjacent position.
Exactly. But it, we have, and in my interview with Sherry Winston last week, we talked a little bit about it, but, you know, she points out that women have as much erectile tissue as men. And,
of course.
And that surprises a lot of people. So the G-spot could be a concentrated part of erectile tissue, because when it's aroused, wherever it is inside the vagina, then it's going to feel a little more corrugated when it's aroused, and it may grow from the size of a dime to a quarter. And I think it's worth exploring. First, maybe the woman needs to do it on her own to find her own.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you see, I know the researcher, including, I don't recall if you were at the WASP conference in Sydney, Australia.
I was not, I'm sorry to say.
Okay. There
Jules Black must have been quite involved with that one.
Yes, and there was a person there who Beverly Whipple started yelling at.
Oh,
which
really?
Was not very cool.
What?
Let me tell
quite
you.
A lot of drama then at the World Congress for Association for Sexology.
Yeah, that's correct. Her contention was that indeed there is this tissue that's very sensitive internal.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I just always present this to students. One needs to entertain that this may merely be, I hate to use the word merely, this is internal extension of the clitoris. Indeed, yes, it is.
Oh, yes. I think that's right. Okay. It could be
and
the root of the clitoris.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to being some magical, special, different tissue. I even have a drawing. In fact, if you look in Love Skills and you have a copy of it, I paid an artist to draw the drawing.
Yeah, where is it? I have your book in my hand.
It's way in the back of the book.
Okay.
The reason I paid an artist was not only to avoid copyright infringement, but it's because I had that artist draw dashes from the clitoris, dash, 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 over to the vaginal wall. It's the lower part. And just to kind of make a point, a lot of women do have a sensitivity on that anterior wall, but there's more than one way to explain what it's all about.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. It's you've got a great drawing, a sectional view of the female genitals on 231. Yeah, it's good. It and let's see. Do you have?
Is it on 231?
Well, that's what my book shows. And this is your sixth edition, right?
You know, if you have page 230, is it not on 230? Not 231? Maybe you've got a slightly.
Oh different. Yeah, it is cross sectional. Yeah, there's both.
Do you see the cross sectional?
I do.
Do you see what I had the artist do? Well,
yeah,
you see the clitoris.
I see that the clitoris. You've got the thing, and then it goes down to all the way into the vagina, the G spot. Yeah, you're showing it.
Yeah, I mean, I just, anyway.
Well, the, Sherry Winston is also an artist, so she did her own drawing that shows the vestibular bulbs right under the labia.
Right. And I'd love to
And in that conference where you presented, and she did in Monterey about 4 years ago. She talked about the vestibular bulbs. And it was kind of news to me. We talked about it last week on the show, but so they're attached to the clitoral head and the cura. So right. I think our bodies are just quite remarkable. So if there's a little bit of light munching on the labia or stimulating with fingers, then those vestibular bulbs will fill up and there's more arousal.
Exactly.
Yeah. So isn't it, don't you think it's quite, the more I learn about anatomy, the more fascinating it is, really.
That's true.
So why don't we move more specifically into touch, because you not only have it in your book, Love Skills, but you presented your research on touch.
Correct.
At the Monterey conference. And I think that the language of touch, well, we speak of being in touch or out of touch, right? Mm-hmm. And then nurturing is a healing touch. And when we did a show in 2014 together on Progressive Radio Network, we talked about your caressing exercises and the getting in touch with touch and touch in a baby's life and how different cultures embrace touch or don't, and the distinction between sensuality and sexuality. So why don't you sort of elaborate on some of that? Yeah, I know it's a bit.
Okay. Well, you know, the thing I start off with, just to remind people, is that the basic term is used that our sense of touch is the mother of all touches, of all senses. It's the very first one to develop prenatally, you know, as a fetus. And it's also the only sense that we have that truly has life or death consequences.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't feel, you will probably die. And we also know that I'm talking about people who would have a physiological malfunction of their sense of touch. And that on the psychological level, we also know you certainly don't go, you don't die because you're blind. You don't die because you can't hear.
Yes.
But if you don't get touched, particularly as an infant, you're at great risk. We won't say it always happens, but you're at great risk for developing what's known as failure to thrive syndrome.
Yes.
Or what they call marasmus. And solid research exists both in the world of humans as well as primates. In terms of the severe damage that occurs if you are not touched in those first couple of years.
It's so true. And they first found that out as a result of some research that developed in World War II when there were all these little German babies who were orphaned.
Exactly.
And it was a failure to thrive. So they were in these orphanages, but they didn't have enough. I mean, they were fed, but they didn't have enough people to hold them and stroke
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
And they often died.
They had a roof over them. They were fed.
Mm-hmm.
The diapers were probably changed, but there was no other contact. That's right.
Right. Yes.
Famous research.
Yes, of course. And it resulted from a very unfortunate circumstance, right?
Right.
So I think a true indicator of a healthy long-term relationship is not how often your partner touches you, but how often your partner touches you in response to your touch. Don't you agree?
I think that's a I think that's a very interesting statement you just made, actually.
And I also think it's interesting. We talked a little bit before about this, in terms of cultures, that warm climates tend to produce cultures that are more liberal about touching than colder regions. So you have to think the Greeks versus the Germans, or the Southern hospitality versus New England Stoicism.
Right, and it's just uncanny. I mean, you know, the research says we're not quite sure why this is true, but it definitely proves to be true, you know. Yes, it's very well documented.
Yes, and then, you know, I will suggest to clients who have no partners but are very frustrated that they get a massage, a weekly massage. And and insurance companies these days, especially in this area, Amazon, Microsoft, they'll often pay for a massage.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
I know. And it turns out that massage is a $1 billion industry in the United States, and that research has shown that Swedish massage with moderate pressure experienced decreases in stress hormones and increases in white blood cells. So this indicated a boost in the immune system.
Oh, that's great. I'm not surprised to hear that.
Yes. And that also massage might be very effective in treating inflammatory and autoimmune conditions. So there was a study a few years ago at Cedars-Sinai in your neighborhood, my old neighborhood. So they had research that showed a link between many forms of touch, from massage to hand-holding, and improved health.
Interesting.
Yeah.
There are so many,
you know, the effects of massage on anxiety. You know, we're finding a biological changes associated with single massage session. Just a single massage. So we all need touch. And could you expand a little bit on your caressing exercises? Because people listening can do them. I mean, they might get better direction if they could actually see a sex therapist and have the directions kind of printed out. That's what I do. But you have in your touch research article introducing caressing exercises, and if you could expand on that, that'd be great.
Well, yes, and I just want to say, you know, I don't recall whether I invented the term, probably I didn't, caressing exercises. But the reason I prefer the term is I think it does evoke almost immediately an image of something that's tender and caring and lighter.
Yeah.
As opposed to massage. So we want to make that distinction between massage versus caressing.
And good point,
and
Linda.
And for me personally, the term sensate focus was just, I candidly remember the first time I heard it. I didn't exactly think it was very clear what it meant. It just seems like a very clinical term to me. So anyway, when I introduce what I refer to as caressing exercises, I'm trying to make it really clear to them that this is not, I'm repeating myself, but this is not an exercise that's designed to, it's not foreplay. Although having said that, there's certain caressing exercises that may eventually turn into foreplay. But when they're first engaged in, they should not be perceived that, they should not be approached that way at all. Because you're really trying to have a standalone experience with the pleasure of touch. And they have to arrange a time. You can't just, you know, oh, by the way, how about if we do some caressing right now? You know, you want to have talked a little bit about it. When would we have some free time? When could we dedicate some time to some really nice touching? And, you know, it depends on whether you've pick the hand versus whole body or whatever, how much time that might be. I do think 15 to 30 minutes would be kind of a minimum.
I agree.
But others, people might say, well, we want an hour, hour and a half. That's kind of, you know, an individual selection. And it's also a matter of couples deciding based on time, based on temperament. Are you going to tend to want to do things so that it's your turn and then my turn? Or would it work out better to just have one person has a turn today and the other person has a turn tomorrow? So that needs to be flexible.
Yeah.
But still, I would say you each get your turn, even if it's not right at the same time.
Exactly.
That's arranged in advance. And both of us already mentioned the idea that it's better to try this exercise, especially initially, without talking during the activity, unless something untoward is happening. And that feedback would be between if they have each take a turn. And you also want to have probably some sort of an oil or lotion, because it reduces the friction of both for the giver and for that matter onto the receiver's skin as well. It shouldn't be anything that's super heavy. It should be alcohol free. And it should be something that appeals to both people. There are various vegetable or nut oils, whether you think of things like almond. I happen to be partial to the smell of almond oil.
Yeah, it smells good.
Avocado, I love the smell of it. Avocado, olive oil is even just fine. And if they were to pick an oil that doesn't have as heavy a scent, they might want to add a few drops of essential oil to it.
And also coconut oil is good.
Oh, yes. Yes, that would be a great one, too.
And that can, as I understand it, that can even be put into the vagina because it's all so organic. It's not going to not going to bother the sensitive vaginal tissues.
And if one prefers a lotion as opposed to an oil, that's all right. And the person who have way back when first suggested this kind of exercise even used to use baby oil. And not baby oil, forgive me. I did not mean to say that. Baby powder. Which is quite interesting.
It might evoke unconscious memories of, because men tend to like the smell of baby powder.
Yeah,
that and pumpkin spice, so I've read. And I think it may evoke some childhood memories or baby memories, baby powder.
And I think it highlights the point that you pick something that you like, not because somebody told you you had to use a certain
product. Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yes.
And that also can encourage other communication because people, as you know, and as I know, have a lot of trouble communicating what they really want and need. Oftentimes they do. So that can be kind of an easy way. Well, I like the smell of baby powder. But as you said, pick something that you like.
Exactly.
And then you can have perhaps a conversation, maybe a negotiation about it.
Right. And just suddenly thinking about some things that are in some of my lecture notes has to do with the fact that, and especially for your audience, that even though it's a while ago, the 94 study that was done on males and females, the famous Chicago random sampling, U.S. population, not clinical, really interesting data that was culled out of that showed that women in their 50s were on average better off than women in their 20s with regard to their sexual experience. They had lower rates of anxiety and higher levels of pleasure. And it did have to do, I mean, we can hypothecate why is that. But mm-hmm. I think most people are aware that women, as they age, become more articulate about
mm-hmm. yes.
their preferences, and they also are a little bit more outspoken about, this is the way I like it, and this is good. As long as it's phrased in positive ways, that's really good to be able to do that.
Well, Gail Sheehy, and she's just such an amazing writer and
oh,
has
yes.
been around for a long time. She talks about how over 50, men often become more romantic and women become more assertive.
Exactly.
And so men learn to slow down, and they often, if they were premature ejaculators in their youth, they often have better control as
right.
an older man. So they slow down and they become a little, their female side, the animus in Jungian terms, develops
right.
more. And the woman becomes more assertive. She's able, her animus, masculine side, develops more. She can say what she wants and needs. She's not going to be shy about it. But also she's had some experience,
exactly.
sexually speaking, right? So she
right.
she knows more about her body and her responses.
Right. And so this is all good. This
it's
is all really good.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I know you said we wanted to say a little bit about body image. That's the other thing.
That's the other thing. Let's try to get that in the last
I just suddenly was noticing.
Well, little bit of time here.
As one does these sensual caressing exercises, one of the things, back to the thing about the person who might be a little more tentative, some of the exercises do not require that one be undressed. And if that's the best beginning, that's just more than okay.
Yeah.
But I would also be mentioning that in terms of body image, on average, again, it turns out that the women in their 50s have better body image than the women in their 20s.
Yes, they have more confidence. And, you know, I think, of course, these days we've got so much media, including porn, that maybe influences. But it's unfortunate because the younger women often believe that they have to have a beautiful body to be alluring and enjoy pleasure.
Exactly.
And, yeah. And I sometimes... It may in some cases be a way to avoid being sexual. I call it self-image neurosis. And that this kind of preoccupation with one's own anatomy may represent a hampering and self-defeating form of sexual narcissism. And typically men don't notice a woman's physical flaws. All they think of is, oh, my God, a naked woman is near me.
Right.
They're not going to be looking at her flaws, but she's often thinking they are.
And I'm thinking of very specifically, actually, of two different cases I had. The more recent was a married couple. He was the one with lower drive, but she was the one with this massive obsession about her body and, you know, he can't see me in the nude and da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
I ultimately, it became appropriate to say, I'm wondering what you would think would happen if you bought a massage table.
Mm.
And I happened to know, and I also currently know, that the place I recommended remains a very good place. It's called Costco. And
mm-hmm.
you can get a rather amazing massage table, complete
mm-hmm.
with the little head thing, you know, that you can put your head in, for much less than most of the massage table stores, if they even exist anymore, or possibly other online venues. But we're back to the baby steps. So not only did they get the table, because they reported after doing an exercise or two, it was a little awkward on the bed and, you know, my arm got cramped and it was
right.
stuff like that.
Right.
So they get the table. She wanted the lights out. But then ultimately I got her, not only did this table work out miraculously well, but I got her to understand that maybe if the lighting were soft,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to pitch black, and it was candlelight or whatever safe life you could come up with that was low, And she did evolve into that as well. It was really rather extraordinary.
Yeah, all of these things are so important for so many people, and setting the scene and the lighting. And I think, yeah, you're right, a massage table adds a lot, and you can take turns not only with caressing exercises on the massage table, which is a better, but, you know, you can go on to other kinds of lovemaking. So if the woman's lying on her back on a massage table, the man can lean over and give her oral sex.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh,
that's
boy.
That's not as wide as a bed would be. Yeah, that's absolutely
true. Right.
Really good.
So
and,
I think, yes, I just think that letting go during sex is really important. And a big, there are important things about letting go. And I think one of them is letting go of how your body used to be. You know, none of us are getting any younger. And our bodies have changed. And for some women, I've heard this in my practice, the energy that she puts into sucking in her belly, hiding her butt, or pretending that she look exactly the way you do, the way you want her, or is energy taken away from the good sex you could be having?
Quite true. Quite true.
So that it's, I think, too, that it's easier to focus on something than to not think of something. So to help let go of thoughts, focus on what feels good in your body.
Exactly.
And that's what the caressing exercises are meant to do. And if you find your mind wandering, I tell my clients, you know, think of seeing a stop sign and gently bring your mind back to the center, how it feels to be touched.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking it's also kind of the baby step stuff. We were implying that people would do this with a partner. But one of the exercises that I added that I had originally used way back when, but I just somehow didn't put it in the book in earlier editions.
Yes.
But it is an exercise. It is what we call as caressing for one. It
caressing
does
for
have
one.
To do with touching. And in the exercise, it has to do with using various different kinds of objects, just so you can, again, attend to what do different things feel like on your skin, and developing that awakening subtlety. But I'm also aware that I used to do it myself sometimes when I was driving a longer drive. You can, if you dare to drive one-handed, you can readily be using one hand to caress your other arm. I'm just saying there's some interesting things one can do in the way of just, it's very self-soothing to stroke oneself. And I'm not even talking about erotic.
I know. You're talking, well, it's very sensual to stroke oneself.
Is.
Yeah, it's not necessarily sexual.
No, it's soothing. It's pleasure. In other words, to me, although maybe that's just me, it's kind of hard to be distracted if you really let yourself be in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, yes, absolutely. And you can do this for yourself. I like that you said that, Linda. And I think it's also important to remember that while most men are more visual than most women, but to keep in mind that men aren't only visual. Some men are tuned into different senses, maybe how you smell or the texture of your skin. And
or sounds.
Sounds, absolutely.
Yeah, the whole auditory thing about, are they going to respond to sweet nothings or anything? Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just to add on, that a lot of women underestimate men's ideals for female weight and shape. That a lot of men enjoy rounded hips, prominent butts, or full cheeks more than most women realize. And I think a lot of men don't want a really skinny woman. They don't want a skinny model they want a woman who can enjoy her body. And I think we need to remember that skinny models are found in women's magazines, never men's.
Right. But I do want to bring up a sort of maybe the bell curve, the opposite side. Remember that some women, as they get significantly older, lose buttocks tissue. My mother would have been an example of that. And so they're not as round as they were in their younger years. So to me, the bottom line is that men like women who are responsive and, you know, who are clearly enjoying themselves.
Absolutely.
They're in their body. And
they're in their body. They're making vocalizations, the sounds. Yeah, they're enjoying their orgasms. Being responsive is, and having an orgasm or multiple orgasms is like applause for many male lovers.
That's true.
Yeah.
Right.
Linda, we're going to hear the music soon. I just want to thank you so much for coming back on this program and giving us your really wonderful erotic ideas. See, there's the music. So you're going to look at your calendar and come back when you can.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Linda. Bye, everybody.
Con calibro affascini il tuo cuore, e se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore,
ma i tuoi piedi, ta 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 ta, ma i tuoi piedi, ta ta.